Tonight we have Travis Warnett, projective dream worker, poet, and musician. He's a trained dream worker currently completing his certification at the Marin Institute for Projective Dream Work with Jeremy Taylor. He worked in the community mental health field in San Francisco for 11 years. He currently has a private practice in Sebastopol and Emeryville and leads group-centered workshops and meetings focused on dream and breath work. And he also does sound healing locally and internationally. He's performed extensively as a musician and professional recording artist and has released 3 studio albums to date. And we have some of his CDs available here that you can peruse after the talk. So without further ado, I give you Travis.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good evening. Welcome. So forgive me if I cough a few times throughout the course of the evening. I had a cold last week and I'm still kind of getting over that. I'd like to start with a poem in the interest of the sacred traditions, some of who believe that what we need to do when we meet like this is to call the spirit down. And so I'd like to do my best to call the spirit down to be with us here tonight by reading one of my original poems. The name of the poem is Some Say. Some say that we are who we are when fully embodied. Others, that we are our true selves in dreams. And still others say that this life is like an illusion we will rise up from someday when we shed the sheath of the body like so many warm blankets in the coolness of the morning. The mystic says that what we truly desire is to cultivate the heart that sees the essence that traverses the landscape of all these territories. And he dances with us, she dances with us, tempting the song that exists within and beyond the separate floors in this palace of being and the 9 levels of sky above. So we sometimes feel into the limitlessness of essence, behind the marching drumbeat hum of time, and know that we are the notes being played in this music, the silence between, and the invisible, delicious taste of the recipe created out of this diverse melange of ingredients. This diverse melange of ingredients. To me, that's an interesting summation of the potential for talking about dreams and dream work and dreaming in an evening like this. So again, welcome. I don't know if I'm going to stay sitting or not. I'm kind of trying to check out whether I'm happy with this or if I'm going to get up and move a little bit. A little bit about my background was already given. I have been doing this work for a number of years, and I recently became quite interested again in it and have become repeatedly or returnedly devoted to it. And I think a good place to start is probably to talk about why dreams. And maybe I can put a question out to you all just to find a general sense of whether people here tonight get a sense of meaning and wisdom, value and worth from your dreams. Can you just raise your hand if you feel like you have a... All right. Oh, that's wonderful. So perhaps dream linguistic friendly culture here this evening. So I'm going to be talking about some of the individual characteristics of dreams and dreaming. I'm going to talk quite a bit about the projective style work that I do and give some benefits of that work that I've seen occur over the 13 or so years that I've been doing it. And I'm also going to talk about the connection between, welcome, the connection between dreams and mythology. And just to sort of set the tone of where I'd like to go with this, I'd like to talk about the concept and the reality of the unconscious. And basically, this is a term that came about as a result of Carl Jung's work in archetypal psychology. He founded what is known today as archetypal psychology. It turns out, as described in this book here, Our Dreaming Mind, by Robert Van de Castle, that there was a familiarity actually with the concept and the term of the unconscious and for the unconscious before Jung really deepened his work around it. And I think a good place to start in talking about the unconscious is to actually quote Jung. He had this to say about the unconscious. The key to the knowledge of the nature of the soul's conscious life lies in the realm of the unconscious. The first task of a science of the soul, and I love that, a science of the soul, the combining of those two elements, is to state how the spirit of man, or we could say humankind, and include women, is able to descend into these depths. These depths being the place, the realm, the mysterious existence of a thing that we call and refer to as the unconscious, where dreams seem to happen. I like to view the unconscious, I like to think about the unconscious in terms of symbolic language. Being a poet, that's helpful for me. And some of you here might also hold this image in your mind when thinking about or dealing with the unconscious. I like to think of it as the ocean, this vast body of water, this vast mysterious place that covers two-thirds of the planet, where, if truth be known, we aren't really fully welcome. We're not fully comfortable there in the water. We exist here on land above the surface of the water, and when we go into the water, we never know what's going to appear to us. We never know what's going to pop out, what's going to show itself. And I find that there's a similarity between that metaphor and the unconscious. In fact, in my dreams and in many of the dreams that I've had the privilege of witnessing and hearing people relay to me over the years, the ocean tends to want to take that symbolic quality itself and refer to something coming up out of the mysterious place of the unknown. It can also be said that the unconscious is the realm where dreams take place, almost as if it's the theater where dreams take place. It's present now, it's present here, it's present when we're asleep, it's present when we're dreaming. And really, this word unconscious is just an attempt to get at, it's a conceptualizing, to my mind, of a notion about this unknown mysterious place. One of the ways that I like to think about it is, right now as I'm talking, there are several things that I'm not aware of, including my metabolism, what all the different things that my body is doing, what my cats are doing at home, what my family's doing in Colorado, and the list could go on and on and on. Something else that I think is worth mentioning about the unconscious is that I think a lot of times it's tempting to think about the unconscious as a place where only what we don't know exists. And there's actually a slight problem with the term itself in that it turns out, particularly in paying attention to dreams and working with dreaming, that there's a very strong feeling sense that there are things in the unconscious that we do know. And so there's an Anglo-Saxon, unconscious itself comes from the Latin, or so I'm told, and there's an Anglo-Saxon word, phrase, that refers to the same thing, which is not yet speech right. And this can be a very helpful term in thinking about dreams, because it refers to something that I might know, or something that we might know, but haven't quite gotten to the stage of being able to articulate in the form of language. Equally true, maybe we haven't quite gotten to the point of being able to turn it into action in our waking lives. So that's the, kind of the first theoretical term that I want to outline. The next would be archetypes. And a lot of my background happens to be in archetypal psychology. And I'll just say that for me, having tried on a few different healing modalities and a few different theories around psychological well-being, the archetypal school, although I'm not dyed-in-the-wool devotee tends to speak the most strongly to my heart and my mind, because it seems to cover so much ground, such a wide range of being and thoughts and ideas. So the term archetypes, basically, as defined by my mentor, one of my mentors, Jeremy Taylor, he sort of sums it up, which is really interesting, because this can get very complicated and complex, as you might imagine. He basically sums it up by calling archetypes the inherent predispositions that shape individual and collective growth and evolution. So that's a pretty wide-ranging concept. When I think of archetypes, when I have thought of archetypes in the past, I think of images like the Buddha here, or Ganesh from India, or I think that's Durga over there on the wall. And certainly these images and these characters from mythology and from world religion do tend to embody archetypal energies, many, several, multitude archetypal energies. And one of the beautiful things I find myself about mythology is that it seems to me the best case for mythology is that it's a tradition of storytelling that seeks to express these inherent predispositions that exist within us and outside of us in storytelling form, so that we can gain wisdom from the stories and so that we can digest the stories. So I think it's also interesting, I was just, to kind of move on here from the theoretical stuff a little bit. This week I saw an article that was published in the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper. It was actually published on the dream list that the Marin Institute for Projective Dreams puts out. And I thought, hey, you know, that's interesting. It was a dream about biologists working on the Farallon Islands. And I thought, hey, you know, this might be really interesting. I wonder what this article has to say. And so I read the article online, and I was both irritated and surprised to find that the very first mention of any dream theorist from the last 200 years was our good friend, the cigar-smoking Sigmund Freud. And The article was like kind of interesting. You know how kind of sometimes newspapers want to sort of elicit interest and sort of skim the surface. And, you know, fair play. A newspaper is only large enough to do that. But I bring Freud up because I'm considering tonight as a bit of an inaugural initiation of myself towards a life's work that has to do with hopefully making more of a conversation in the world around dreams and dreaming, and getting beyond sort of referring always to this one figure who was gladly brought back a serious study and a scientific endeavor to understand dreams, however sadly fell quite short, in my view, of providing a expansive understanding of what dreams might be about. As Michael Mead has said, you know, Freud, he had his issues, he had his problems, you know, he's going through some stuff, you know, so, you know, we can have compassion for that. But to my mind, far more interesting are dream researchers like Carl Jung or Robert Van de Castle or Sanford, who has a book here, Arnold Mindell, who also has a book here. There's just such a wealth, really. I suspect that you all here tonight have quite a wide-ranging understanding of different dream theories, given that we're in Sebastopol and we're in Northern California.
Good guess.
Yeah, thank you, my friend. So you know, it's hard to say with a group this size whether I'm saying things that people are already going to be familiar with in terms of the theoretical stuff or not, but I offer them through the unique lens of my own understanding and experience. So, on that note, since I'm riffing on Freud, I think I want to talk about psychology for a brief instant. As was mentioned in giving my background, my professional background, I did work for several years in the mental health field in what was considered to be a progressive arena for mental health in San Francisco. It might be progressive, In fact, if I were pressed to the point, I'd have to say it is. However, sadly and unfortunately, I believe it still falls prey to some of the pathologizing and, you know, blaming people for their own problems kind of work that happens. But I find the word itself, psychology, to be very interesting, because I sort of feel like it's possible that we might have kind of lost the way, you know. It's turned into a science of measurement, as so many other sciences have become. And it's kind of like, you know, has anybody like thought about the word lately? The word is psychology. The roots being psyche from the Greek. Psyche means the soul, and psyche also means butterfly. And so it's kind of like the study of the soul. And, you know, it's right there in the word. How are we missing that? You know, what happened? You know, hello. And I just really want to make an argument and a case for bringing the soul back into transformative work, back into studies of ourselves and how we change and grow in life.
As you get going into this, I was just wondering if you could tell us from your perspective what the use or purpose of dream work is.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe the use and purpose of dream work. Yeah. Maybe I should actually, I had planned to give an idea of all of the different things that I was going to talk about. Maybe I'll do that now. Thank you. So I'm going to riff a little bit on theory tonight, and I'm also going to share a story from the Greek mythological tradition, and then I'm also going to spend, during the last piece, some serious time talking about dream work and the benefits of dream work, how that goes, what it looks like, so on and so forth. I just kind of want to, my intention here is to provide a bit of a backdrop for sort of understanding the perspective that I take on doing this work with people and doing group work. And I hope by the end of the evening it'll all fit together nicely. And I also, as you may be aware of, I'm also going to give a brief sound healing at the end of the evening as we close. So I was bringing up psyche in the ultimate interest of, about 4 days ago I was thinking about my talk and the story of psyche popped into my head. And so I went back and looked at that story that hails from the Greek mythological tradition. And, you know, the point about myths and mythology, as we've been wonderfully reminded by our friend Joseph Campbell, it's not whether or not these stories are true or false, which, you know, a lot of times the scientific viewpoint is to say, yeah, you know, these old stories, they're not true. You know, why would we pay attention to them? They didn't really happen. But it's kind of like this is also true with dreams and dreaming. The point is not whether what's happening there is true or false. It's more of a matter of developing and cultivating our mythic and symbolic ability to understand these narratives. And Joseph Campbell also said that myths are like public dreams, and that dreams, individual dreams, are like private myths. And so, in the interest of fleshing that out a bit, I'd like to tell the story of the woman who became Soul. There were three daughters born to a family, a common Greek family in Greece. The two older daughters, happily married when they came of age, found themselves suitable husbands and were glad to be married off. And the youngest and the most beautiful of the three sisters remained unwed. It came to pass that the people in Greece stopped going to the temple of Venus and making offerings, the goddess of love, mind you. And Venus became aware of this fact, and became aware of the fact that the young woman's psyche was indeed, in fact, the woman who was so beautiful, reputedly more beautiful than Venus, that people would forget to go to the temple and leave offerings for the goddess of love. In her upset and anger over this, Venus decided, I must bring my son, Cupid, the god of love, to my aid. I will ask him, Cupid, come here. I have a favor to ask of you. My good son, my dutiful son, you see this beautiful mortal, this beautiful and silly woman who thinks that she's more beautiful than I am. Do you see her? Come on in.
Welcome.
Cupid says, you know, yeah, I see her. She's gorgeous. To himself. He's thinking this to himself. No sooner does Cupid look at Psyche than he falls in love with her himself. Venus has no idea that this is what's happening, and she says, I want you to go down there, fly from Mount Olympus. I want you to go and find the most decrepit, ugly, worthless man you can possibly find. Shoot him with one of your arrows and make Psyche fall in love with him, because she needs to be brought down a couple notches. Cupid agrees. Venus confidently, even arrogantly, some might say, leaves the room, knowing that her son is going to achieve her ends. Cupid, meanwhile, has devised a whole plan for meeting up with Psyche, and he's actually gone so far as to go to the oracle of Apollo to say, my good fellow man, my good fellow god, would you do me this small favor? In a little while, there's a father, a nervous father, who's going to come to you, and he's going to say to you, my two oldest daughters have been wed, but my most beautiful and youngest daughter has yet to find a husband. Good Apollo, what shall I do? When he says this, asks Cupid, would you please tell him kindly to take this fair young woman out onto the hillside, away from people, away from the village, away from the town, and expose her? Apollo says, all right, you know, you are the god of love. You are my brother. I will do what you ask. And so it comes to pass that Psyche's father journeys to the oracle and is told this horrible news by the oracle of Apollo. You must go and expose your daughter on a hillside, and you must treat her as if she is dead to you. The father goes home and tells the family, and immediately everybody is extremely upset. And Psyche herself throws up her hands and says, oh, well, perhaps this is a fitting end for me after all. I haven't exactly had a good time of things so far in this life. And they take her out. They take her out and they expose her on the hillside. And they leave her, and on their way they're weeping and they're grieving and they're gnashing their teeth, and they have to give up the most beautiful daughter in their family, and this breaks their hearts. They leave her, and again she has resigned herself to her fate, when suddenly this warm, gentle wind, known as the Zephyr, comes to her and lifts her up off of the hillside and drops her down in a valley below. As she's gently resting there, she looks and she sees a beautiful palace, a gorgeous, phenomenal thing with golden pillars and silver walls, and she walks in, feeling curious, as most of us would. She walks in the door, and as she does so, she hears voices telling her that any of her heart's desires shall be given in this place. She thinks to herself, well, not bad. You know, I was on the hillside earlier today being exposed and left for dead. Now I'm in a golden silver palace temple. And it's not long before Cupid himself arrives, and night comes, and he explains to Psyche that he is her husband. He asks for her hand in marriage, and she says, well, I don't see anything better coming along anytime soon. And he says, the only thing is, you can't see me. I will, because I am who I am, I will remain forever invisible to you. And she thinks, well, you know, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool place. I think I'll hang out, you know. It's nice. So she lives there, and she develops an experience of enjoying her new life with great enthusiasm. And it also comes to pass that she feels quite lonely. I know I would. She says to Cupid eventually, "You know, I don't get to see you. I don't have any visitors. I'd love to see my family sometime. You know, they think I'm dead. They left me on a hill to be exposed, and I disappeared." And he says, my good wife, I can entirely understand that you would be lonely and that you would want to see your family. However, I am here to tell you that that's not such a good idea." She accepts this the first time, she accepts this the second time, but she really is feeling lonely, and she eventually decides, "I'm going to press my point with my man." And she says, I really want to see my sisters." And he says, "Well, my good wife, I love you. You're very special to me and you're important. I cannot refuse you. But I must warn you that there is a seed that contains your end in this request." So Psyche contacts her sisters. Actually, she asks the Zephyr to go and contact them because she's not really sure exactly where she's at. The Zephyr goes and contacts the sisters, and the sisters come for a visit. And immediately they see the opulence, and they see the gold pillars, and they see the silver walls, and all of the gifts and treasures that are there. And they immediately become jealous, thinking to themselves, "Ha! How did she manage this, exposed on a hillside and left to die? This is far better than anything that we have." And they develop, they devise a strategy at that moment in their minds. They go away that night, and they talk about it, and they decide, you know, what gives? She's the most beautiful one, and she gets this like amazing place to live, and you know, so on and so forth. They're both aware of the fact, because Psyche has told them, that she's never seen her husband, that in fact he's invisible. They come back the next day and they say, "You know, sis, we thought about this, and we're kind of worried about you. You know, you're the youngest one, and you know, people were always wanting to give you what you wanted because you're so beautiful and all that stuff. We're here to tell you, this is not a good thing. We believe that the evil snake at the oracle of Apollo has turned himself invisible and has wed you, and that he will eat you before too long when he becomes bored and tired of you. And this is what we think you should do, dear sister. We think tonight, after we leave, you should go into the bedroom, place a lamp beside the bed, and keep a long knife there. And when your husband falls asleep, make good and well sure that he is deeply asleep. Light the lamp and look upon him and realize the truth of our words. But do not hesitate too long, Psyche. Pick up the knife right away and plunge it deep into this evil serpent's heart." And so Psyche has become nervous at this point, taking on her sister's idea of what's really happening here, and she thinks to herself all evening while she's waiting to go to bed with her invisible husband, "I don't know who this guy is. I feel that I love him. I feel that he loves me, but I really don't know who he is. It could be a divine being pulling the wool over my eyes. I must at least try the plan that my sisters have suggested and see if I can find out more for myself." So they go to bed that night. Cupid falls asleep, and Psyche lights the oil lamp. And as she lifts it up, she realizes, she looks upon Cupid, the god of love. What a beautiful, gentle soul he is. And she thinks to herself, "This is incredible. My sisters have deceived me. Look at this beautiful man who has chosen to have me as his wife." She leans closer, thinking to herself, "Wouldn't it be nice to give a real kiss to his cheek and to touch him? He's so beautiful after all." And as she does so, she trips, and just a little bit of the oil spills out of the oil lamp and falls on his shoulder. He wakes up and immediately looks at her, realized what has happened, and says, "My good wife, I'm so sorry that this has happened. Love cannot exist where there is no trust." And he flies back to Olympus, leaving Psyche to wonder about all of this. Psyche doesn't take long to decide that she's going to go and find him, that she's going to go and prove to him that she loves him. and that they ought to be together. Meantime, Kippa comes back to Mount Olympus with a wound in his shoulder, and his mother, the goddess of love, sees him coming and says, "My son, have you done the thing that I asked of you?" Cupid is forced into saying, "Well, mother, the truth is I have not, and in fact I have been wounded." Normally, Venus would be happy to tend her son's wounds, but under the conditions, she leaves him to heal on his own. In fact, sends him to his room and locks the door and says, "Don't come out until I tell you to." Meantime, Psyche is looking around for Cupid, and Venus decides, "I'm going to get that girl. My son didn't take care of it. I'm going to do it right. I'm going to find her, and I am going to bring her down several notches, not just a couple notches. Now I'm thinking I need to bring her down several notches, because she bested me with my own son." And so it comes to pass that eventually the two do encounter each other. And Psyche is incredibly nervous, finding Venus, realizing this must be the goddess of love. And she knows that the goddess of love is Cupid's mother, and she knows that she's married to the god of love. Venus says, "Oh, it's so nice to meet you. You're looking for my son. Oh, I understand. Oh, yes, you'd like to find my son. Yes, well, let me teach you a few things first about being a good woman so that you can be a good husband for my son." Thus begin the trials of our dear woman Psyche. Venus says, first off, she grabs a whole shelf full of a variety of seeds and dumps them on the floor. Millet, grain, wheat grains, all types of seeds, sesame seeds, and she mixes them all together. And she says, "You know, in order to be a good wife, you ought to be able to sort this pile out by sundown. It's mid-afternoon. You have plenty of time. I'll be back when the sun has set." Psyche is sitting, looking at this great mess in front of her, thinking to herself, "Wow, I've really done it this time. There's no way I'm going to be able to do this." When, out of nowhere, the ants, who have taken pity on her, heard her protestations and cries, have come walking, marching, all together. The family, the tribe of ants, the whole tribe of ants has come to help out Psyche. And they dutifully and masterfully and quickly sort the pile of seeds into their proper piles. Venus comes back and opens the door and sees Psyche sitting there somewhat meekly looking at the piles. Venus throws her hand to her head and says, "Clearly, you must have had some help with your task. The task I have set you is not nearly difficult enough. So let me set you to more tasks." It goes on like this for a while. She sets Psyche to the task of collecting water from the river Styx, and an eagle comes and says, "You know, I don't think it's such a good idea for you to do that. I think I'll do it for you." And he takes the bottle out of her hand and he goes, because the river Styx is difficult to approach as a human mortal. Human mortals aren't actually able to get next to it without getting into it. And the name of the river Styx is also hateful, because everything that is disgusting and gross and terrible and everything that has to do with death is in it. She sets Psyche one final task, because Psyche returns with the bottle full of the water from the river Styx and gives it to Venus. Venus, meanwhile, thinking, "You know, she's starting to look a little bit disheveled. I think I'm starting to enjoy this. By the time I'm done with her, she can go and talk to Cupid all she wants. She will not be nearly as beautiful as she was when she started." And she thinks a particularly cruel trick to play on Psyche would be to send her down into the underworld to procure the thing that is existing there that can bring beauty even to mortal women, but especially to the goddesses, and especially to the goddess of love. She doesn't tell her what this thing is. She says, "There is a goddess in the underworld named Persephone. I want you to go to the underworld, ask Persephone for my usual, and return dutifully and rapidly. Go now." Psyche goes and she meets Persephone and she finds the thing that Persephone has. Persephone puts it in the box, gives it to her, and says, "Now, my child, go and return this to Venus." And as is the case in so many stories, especially Greek stories, she pops back onto the surface of the earth into the light of day. She starts to feel a little bit better. She's not in the underworld anymore where it's dark and kind of scary to mortals. And she's holding this box and she thinks to herself, you know, wouldn't hurt just to take one little peek, would it? I wonder what Venus has in here that keeps her so beautiful. She opens the box and immediately falls to sleep on the road. Meantime, Cupid, back at the ranch, Mount Olympus, in his room, has pretty much mended. And he's thought a lot about things because he's had a lot of time to think about them on his own, being in a certain form of exile. And he says, I really love that woman. I really love that beautiful mortal woman. I ought to go find her. And he looks at the bars on his window and he realizes, I have wings. I can fly. It doesn't matter that my mother has locked me here. I'm going to go find Psyche now. And he flies out, and it doesn't take long for him to find Psyche, and she's asleep on the road with a small box near her. Cupid recognizes the box, by the way. And he wipes the sleep from her eyes and says, my good Psyche, at last we are reunited. And she says, I know, it's beautiful, it's wonderful to see you, and by the way, I love you very much. But your mom is trying to do me in. And he says, I know, I'm not surprised. I have the perfect solution. And he goes to Zeus, and he says, Zeus, I have fallen in love with a mortal woman, a woman so beautiful that mortal human beings neglected Venus's offerings for several weeks, even months on end, to admire her beauty. Would you please give me her hand in marriage officially, and would you please also make her an immortal being? Zeus, meanwhile, who has lots of good reasons to be angry at Cupid, because Cupid's always shooting his arrow in him and making him fall in love with extramarital persons outside of his marriage, he says, well, you know, you've done a lot of things, kid. You've done a lot of things. But the fact of the matter is, I can't ignore your request, because you are a god and I am the father of the gods. Consider it done. And so it is that in this particular Greek myth, we come to the archetypal happy ending. Psyche and Cupid are wed. Psyche is made an immortal. Venus no longer hates her because she will now dwell in Mount Olympus, where mortals won't think on competing for the beauty of the goddess of love with mortal women. And all is well. That ends well. And it is said, in the version that I read, which comes from the Edith Hamilton mythology, the Greek mythology, that this is how the Psyche, or Psyche, became soul. And I chose to tell this story because I think it illustrates very interestingly several dynamics and aspects of dream work and dreams. On the surface, you know, when I read this story, and you might be thinking this now too, it's kind of like, yeah, well, it's a happy story for straight people who end up, you know, like, you know, the happy couple, you know, the man and the woman, the beautiful woman and the god of love. However, I find that there are a lot of elements within this story that point towards archetypal layers of meaning. And the first of which I'd like to point out, just briefly, Psyche goes through a trial of suffering. And suffering is one of the qualities that, across the board in ancient and modern cultures, is associated with soul work. There's the scene where Psyche decides she wants to look upon her invisible partner in the middle of the night with an oil lamp. To my mind, this typifies in symbolic, imagistic form what we do with dreams. We try to cast the light of awareness on something that is invisible, that exists perhaps inside of us. I think and feel that it does exist within us, inside of us. Then there's also the series of impossible tasks that she is made to perform. And I think of the impossible tasks as the sort of things and the sort of thing that happens to us when we're dreaming. You know, these impossible things that don't seem to be able to happen during waking life, like you know, cups going upwards, rivers flowing upwards, great piles of seeds being organized, not by human hands, but by the hands of nature. The energies of nature appear to assist psyche. I think that's also characteristic of dreams and dreaming as well. So that's my little piece about wanting to bring the soul back into psychology. And actually, before we transition and talk about some other things, I'm just curious to know if anybody has any comments at this point to share, or any questions or thoughts. No problem. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, looking at the story as a dream as well, the animals that came to her aid are also the instincts. Our instincts work for us when we're not looking.
Yes, thank you. Well put. Yes, yes, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I chose the story, just to illustrate in, you know, creative mythological form. Yeah, what tends to happen for us in dreams. So, at this point, I'd like to transition over and talk about the benefits of this work and also what this work looks like. I do this work in groups of people that are generally between 6 and 8 in number, but as recently as this weekend, did a group work with 17, I think we had over the weekend. And the basic idea of projective group dream work is that, in essence, we all tend to project our own reality out as we perceive things. And another reason why I wanted to tell that story was because I'm sure that as I was talking, I'm sure that each of you found a different part of the story to be significant or meaningful. Or maybe, you know, maybe somebody in the room had the thought like, that's kind of stupid, you know, why would she do that? Or why would he do that? This is an illustration in a mythological narrative and the listening to it of the way we project. And I don't know if projection is an unfamiliar term to the people in this room or not. I imagine it probably isn't. But it's basically the crux of the type of group dream work that I do, that I enjoy doing. And there are any number of advantages to this approach. First and foremost, that an individual dream can be shared and looked at in a group setting in a safe and successfully vulnerable fashion. In other words, if we were all meeting right here, right now, doing group dream work together, I could share a dream. If we're going to do the work on the basis that we're all going to project meaning and levels of understanding onto any dream that is shared, I can safely feel that it's all right to share a dream, and I can feel like the rest of the people here are going to take responsibility for their own levels of understanding or insight around the dream. The way that we do this in projective work is we have a language structure that's kind of a basic agreement that we start off with. And the language structure has a couple of varieties, but the primary one is that each person in discussing and looking at a shared dream in the group would agree at the outset of the group to use the language similar to, if it were my dream, it might mean this, 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 or this. And that allows for any type of comment to be shared about a dream and also about any experience in life. I think it's one of the benefits of this group work that I've been doing for 13 years is that taking this approach tends to cultivate a practice of more often than not looking at daily interactions in the same way. So rather than, you know, saying to somebody, let's say I'm talking with a coworker and the coworker says, man, you know, like, I come home from work and my wife starts yelling at me and, you know, I just can't take it anymore and, you know, she's complaining that I'm drinking, I'm having too many beers, and I'm not, and, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, okay, how am I going to, how am I going to address this? And I think probably we could all agree in this room that oftentimes, maybe not 9 times out of 10, but oftentimes the temptation is for some sort of comment to be made like, well, man, you know, you should just get out of there, or you should just, you know, tell her that that's not true. But that probably isn't going to be helpful in the long run. And as I'm saying it, I'm not sure it's the best example, but the idea is that if somebody is sharing some information about something that's happening for them, and I say, like, well, you know, you really should, you sound kind of crazy. You know, you sound, yeah, you got some troubles there, you got some problems, you know, maybe you should get some therapy or something. The ultimate effect of that approach is not going to necessarily be a positive or a helpful one. And the same is true of the kind of group dream work that I do. And so the experience of an actual group meeting is that each person agrees to say this and to really take it on. In fact, the recent discussions have been around this, that it might even be more true to say about a dream that's being shared, that in my imagined version of this dream, and in doing that, I'm taking full responsibility for the fact that whatever I'm seeing in the dream is basically based on my unique set of life circumstances, my upbringing, my psychological experience throughout the course of life, all the ideas and experiences that I've had that are unique and individual to me. I'm taking responsibility for those things. So the flip side in this group work is that there's huge benefit to the people who aren't sharing a dream in that moment. When one dream is being shared, as we recently had happen in one of the small groups that I'm in, one of the individuals said, well, you know, I see it like when I bring a dream and share a dream, it's like a gift that I'm just putting out into the room, and then everybody gets to enjoy and partake of that gift. And it's really, in this particular approach to dream work, it's really true. And it's amazing because I've seen it happen time and time again in the groups that I've done. You know, people come and they have their dreams and they're excited. You know, they want to work their dream and, you know, it's kind of pressing. And, you know, you can really only do in an evening, depending on the number of people that you have in your group, you can really only do a couple dreams, 2 or 3, usually. And so, you know, the experience that I had when I first started doing the group dream work was, like, similar. I kind of wanted to work my dream. You know, I kind of wanted to do that. Do we know where that's coming from?
It's not mine. It wasn't mine. Somebody up there, I think, it's the musical emphasis.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a musician. I'll accept the soundtrack. I'll accept the soundtrack. So it really is amazing because a lot of times the feeling will be, wow, I didn't get to work my dream. I really wanted to work my dream. And sometimes that's, you know, perfectly acceptable feeling to have. But what happens in these groups, which is amazing, is that when people start projecting onto the dream, which happens, people start to realize, wow, I'm having this experience of being able to project onto this other person's dreams. And because I'm finding meaning within that, I get a chance to review or maybe even witness for the first time the knowledge and the information and the insight that I'm having as I look at a particular dream narrative. Is that making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
So you're saying that the goal is to derive insight from the story that's being told?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, if I didn't say it before, I had intended to say that one of the biggest reasons for doing this work, for doing dream work, to my mind, is that the dreams always eventually show up. No matter what healing modality I've been involved in over the many years that I've been working in the helping professions, the dreams always eventually show up. And people, including myself, feel, what do I do with this? What do I do with this material? And I can speak from my experience, and I can also speak on behalf of other people that I've seen experience this. There are a lot of times that I will remember a dream and I'll wake up and I'll think like, you know, wow, what was that? You know, yuck. And I've been studying dreams for many years. So to be able to wake up and have that reaction and that response says something about how we each experience dream memories. And it leads me into pointing out another of the benefits of group work, that I do one-on-one work, and that's very beneficial and helpful. I've been the recipient of one-on-one work around dreams. But I'm also here to say that it seems like what happens in the groups is that there's a lot more insight and wisdom that's available, that's being shared. Because instead of, if we're working a dream together, instead of just our two unique, individual, diverse viewpoints being given to the dream, if we have this entire room of people sharing insights, or an entire group of six or eight people sharing insights, that suddenly becomes a lot more rich and a lot more vibrant. And it does a service to everybody who's involved by providing a multiple layer of insights and meanings around the dreams. Again, I'll just invite you to, if anybody has a comment or a question, feel free to raise your hand at this point. Yes?
Do you look at dreams from a more psychological perspective, or do you also go into the dreams personally?
Thank you. That's a good question. All of the above. Yeah. All of the above. Yeah, I think it's, in my experience, it's been wonderfully striking how the dreams seem to be speaking to all of the important issues of life. Another good reason to pay attention and to work with dreams, to my mind. That the dreams, even though they speak in the language of metaphors and symbols, they're coming to tell me something that I don't already know. They might come to tell me something that I do already know, but they're also going to come to tell me something that I don't already know. And they're going to come, we say, in projective group work, we say that dreams speak on multiple levels of meaning, with multiple layers of meaning, and that they're overdetermined. And what this means is basically that, you know, I can recall and share a dream about a snake, for instance. And on one level, the dream might be having to do with a physical warning. It might be, on one level, it might be an omen. I might be staying out in the woods or in the country, and I might not be paying attention to where I'm walking. And my dream might be coming to tell me, like, you know, look out, pay attention, you know. On another level, it might be speaking to me of a relationship to an experience of kundalini energy that seems to be spontaneously coming about in my life. And all the gradations, you know, depending on the details of the dream itself. Any other questions or comments this time? Let's see how we're doing here.
Travis, I'll just underscore your point about the power of projective group dream work.
Okay.
Because I had worked with my dreams for years, just myself, you know, underlining the symbols, and I got a lot out of it. But it wasn't until I went to a group that I really understood how everybody that shares that dream, let's say there's six people in the group, somebody shares a dream, well, now there's six people go home with six different versions of that dream with their own insights. So it's a real opportunity through one dream to have a lot of consciousness raising. It's really beautiful how that works. I just wanted to underscore that point.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And I like how simple and complicated it can be. Because when I first started doing dream work, I thought, oh, these people know all these myths, they know all these archetypes, I didn't know anything about any of that. But I had life experience, and so I did a lot of studying, read a lot of books, and go to a lot of dream groups. And at one point, there was one dream where I realized it didn't really matter, because there was a symbol for wherever I came from. So if I was an engineer, there was an engineer's symbol for this concept. If I was a lawyer, there was a lawyer one. If I was a philosopher, there was a philosophical one. And they all said a similar thing. So it can be as uneducated or overeducated as you want to be, because it is overdetermined.
Right.
So it can be simple or it can be really complicated depending on where I want to go with it. So, and I often have to remind myself of that sometimes.
Yes, thank you. It's so true. And even though the presentation that I'm giving tonight has sort of a psychological flair to it, because that is a big chunk of my background, even though that's the case, it's also very true that in doing this work, the things that I've been talking about with their big fancy names and, you know, the mythological narrative that I shared, all of these things, if we were to sit down in a group with people who weren't familiar with these things and just explained the basic format of the group and just some basic ideas around what dreams seem to be speaking about, then we could easily do some really good dream work. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is, and this is another caveat about why I do group dream work, the fact of the matter is we all have intuition and we all have a relationship with the unconscious and the not yet speech ripe. And what happens, part of the reason that this work is so exciting, is that you start to work on a dream and the experience happens that, you know, the person who seems to be the least well educated, you know, on this topic and has the least amount of training, you know, the engineer who drinks a lot on weekends, you know, comes out with this sparkling insight about the dream. And it's a wonderful experience. And this work is designed and set up to be democratic, quote unquote. The idea is that all of us will have something to contribute. And that certainly has been my experience. I've done groups in the classes where I studied with Jeremy Taylor in Oakland. I've done groups at my home, in my living room. I've done groups with other people in Marin. I've done groups out at Burning Man, of all places, in the desert, on the Burning Playa. And actually, now that I mention that, it reminds me of an example that I'd like to share of one of the things that happened. My partner and I, who's here this evening, when we decided we wanted to go out there to Burning Man, we wanted to create something that was meaningful, you know, and something that offered back to people who were there. And so I decided I wanted to do dream work groups, and we just put a sign up and said, you know, stop by at 10:30 in the morning, we're doing a dream group. And so it was mostly like a group of us who were in this camp, but then there was also this sort of stray individual who showed up, and he said, hey, I'm interested in doing some dream work. You guys doing that? Yeah, come on, sit down. Turned out that this fellow wanted to work a dream, and it was a recurring dream that basically hadn't changed, you know, just little details here and there, little iotas, for like 30 years or something like that. And he said, you know, can you please help me with this apparently ridiculously mundane and meaningless dream that I keep having that's driving me crazy? And we said, yeah, sure, you know, we'll do our best. Let's see what happens. And so the dream, in brief, had him basically in college taking his final exams and not passing. And, you know, we asked him, like, kind of some questions about his waking life, you know, scenario. And he said, I graduated, I went into a profession, you know, and I still have these dreams. You know, why is this stupid dream bugging me for all these years? And as the work went on, it came out that he was working at a profession that he didn't particularly like, but that he had signed on for when he graduated from college. And, you know, he didn't actually have a huge problem with his finals. He did pretty well with his finals. And as we were doing the work and we were talking about it, we're kind of like saying, like, well, what are you doing out here at Burning Man, you know? And he said, well, you know, as a matter of fact, I kind of showed up here because I'm just kind of like interested in changing my life. And it turned out that he felt that he understood the dream for the very first time over a course of like 30 years, and that he felt like working the dream unlocked a piece for him that he could finally like let that go, the performance anxiety of the final exams and all that, and sort of sink into the kind of life that he hoped to create for himself. So that was hugely gratifying. That's on like my top five list of gratifying dream work moments, to have a guy show up, you know, who said, oh, I've been having the same dream for so many years, and it demonstrates very, very well one of the other things that I'd like to say about the theoretical stuff, that even the most mundane, grubby, simple, plain dreams have archetypal energies in them that are inherently predisposed to moving us and, I think, each other towards deepened growth and evolution in life. And it's just worth considering that if you haven't before. The last theoretical, this other thing just popped into my mind. The other thing that I want to say about theoretical issues is, one of the things we go over at the beginning of a group dream work meeting is we talk about how there's no such thing as a bad dream. Only dreams that sometimes come in a negative fashion in order to grab our attention. And I just want to offer this to you all tonight, because in my experience of talking with people, even people who are familiar with various dream theories and work on their own dreams and record their own dreams, I oftentimes, 9 times out of 10, meet people that if they share a dream with me and it's a horrible, disgusting, terrible, nasty dream, you know, they'd rather kind of not talk about it, because the experience is what we call mistaken literalism. Like, you know, I've had some pretty gnarly dreams myself recently, and it really does happen that I wake up and I think to myself, the other night I woke up at 3 a.m. and I was like, wow, thank God, that was just a dream, you know. And then I sort of woke up a little bit and I said, that's kind of funny that I just said that. Yeah. I know a lot about dreams and I work on dreams a lot. But it happens. It happens to all of us. And did I say anything about mistaken literalism before?
No, not really.
Right, okay, thank you. And so this is just an example of the way sometimes it might be tempting to see things on the surface, you know, like the Psyche story. If somebody just told me that story out of the blue and it wasn't in a context, you know, I love mythology, but I might think, you know, like, yeah, that's from the Greeks and they were just a bunch of patriarchs and it's just a, like, kind of a sappy love story, you know, but it has more in it. And I'm just saying that as an example of the tendency to go towards mistaken literalism, which I think is a consequence of, you know, the age of reason, that we're seeming to begin to sort of like, you know, grow extra legs and want to crawl up out of the so-called age of enlightenment, in which symbolic thinking and symbolic understanding has suffered a great deal. So, another part of, yes?
Oh, I don't want to interrupt.
No, please, go ahead. By all means, I want to hear what you have to say.
I wanted to ask you about your background in mental illness and working with people with mental illness, and the intersection of dream work and mental illness, both in terms of when you do group work and people show up, and they might not always know that they have issues going on, and the boundaries and that sort of thing, but also the role of dream work and in how you work with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to hear just whatever thoughts you have about it, because there's so much shadow surrounding mental illness.
Yes.
And it seems like a perfect, dream work feels like a perfect way to
absolutely
launch.
Yeah,
into
very much so. In my experience, I used to work in an acute residential treatment facility, and we were getting people straight from psych hospital. And so these are people that have probably tried to kill themselves, either by doing some sort of harmful act to themselves, maybe trying to hurt somebody else in a highly destructive way, or maybe living on the streets, homeless, no money, and using the hardest drugs known to humankind on a very regular basis. And I was working as an administrator for a while, an assistant program director, and sometimes my staff would be so harried with all the things that they had to do that they would beg me. I told them, I said, you know, if you guys ever want to do a dream work group, I'd be happy to do that. And so it came to pass that several times I was asked to do a dream work group. And it was always very interesting, because one of the main issues that I see there is that, at least within the confines of the system, the mental health system as it exists, even if it's a progressive organization, which I worked for, there's still all of these limits put upon the individuals and a lot of judgments, you know, like, oh, if you do that, it's going to be bad for you, so we won't let you do that. There are a lot of restrictions on freedom. And it turns out that a lot of the restrictions on freedom have to do with funding and Medi-Cal and, you know, getting paid to provide services to people. So that's like, you know, a tricky area. But I would just say that in my experience, offering the group work was always beneficial for both myself and for the individuals who were in the group. Of course, because of the level of trauma that's sometimes present, you know, I would walk away from the group kind of thinking, like, it's hard to see if there's a positive impact here or not. But I remember, and there always felt like there was, I remember we worked a dream of one individual who shared a dream of being visited by a dead ancestor. And this would be the kind of thing that would normally land a person back into the psych unit, you know. Yeah. Well, you're seeing ghosts. Yeah, we gotta change your meds or increase your meds, or, you know, how you feeling? Are you feeling safe? Are you gonna hurt yourself or somebody else? That sort of thing. But in the group work, we were actually able to. I was actually able to say, well, not in the dream world, not an uncommon experience, you know, and perhaps in spirited form, this person was being visited. I suggested that perhaps they were being visited by their ancestor, and wasn't it, you know, interesting to be able to have that kind of contact? So that opened up. It was very empowering. And that's another take-home message that I want to provide. This work is immensely empowering, because it's not like, you know, the kind of psychoanalytic model that I was referring to earlier, where a lot of times, you know, I tell people I'm a dream worker, you know, and in some company, they're like, oh, that's different, and they walk off. You know, like, as it, and I wonder about that. I think, like, well, why does that happen? You know, and I think sometimes people feel like they're going to get analyzed. You know, I'm going to put them on the metaphorical couch if they start to talk about dreams. The opposite also happens, where I'll just be having a casual exchange with somebody, and I'll tell them that I'm a dream worker, and they'll say, wow, I had this crazy dream last night. Let me tell you all about it. I was flying, and there were Martians, and I was in the bathtub. Like, whoa, yeah, let's book a session. Here's my information. yeah, thank you for that. Does that help?
Yeah. In terms of boundaries, do you feel like you have to set any boundaries? Many people are not aware. I mean, you're talking about a pretty extreme population. But
yeah.
I'm imagining there are a lot of people among us who, you know, borderline tendencies or are depressed and don't know it. And
right.
How do you work with that in your dream work, in group dream work?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's great. Thanks for reframing that. Another one of the I think, fantastically wonderful things about this work is that, and I've done a lot of one-on-one with people in mental health where I kind of felt like, oh, geez, you know, I don't want to talk about this. This is pretty intense. But in talking about dreams, we have something else to talk about. And it's my conviction, my deeply held conviction, that the dreams will give us exactly what we're ready for, or we wouldn't remember it in most cases. And I would even say in extreme cases. And I know people that have done group dream work, including myself, with people that are considered to be extremely disturbed. Mm-hmm. And I've gone there with a couple individuals, and I know people that have gone there with a couple individuals. And as long as the tone of the work is, let's see what this dream might be saying. Mm-hmm. You know, and as long as there's a good tone to the work, you know, owning the projections that are taking place, I find it's helpful when working with people to keep myself up to date on, you know, potential meanings of certain dream situations. I try to always be reading something, you know, at least like once a month for a certain period of time that has to do with dreams and dream work, to keep myself brushed up, so that, you know, if, you know, it, when I hear a dream still to this day, even in a dream work group, I sort of feel like, and Jung actually recommended that we do this, you know, just clearing the decks. I don't know anything about this. Let's see what the dream itself might have to say. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if certain theoretical points seem helpful at that moment, then it's probably a good idea to go there. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
What was the phrase that you used about literalism?
Mistaken literalism.
Mistaken literalism.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the two points of projection you made that we project onto others, our idea of what the dream is. Mm. And then there's the projection of the dream, and I've seen this over and over. Mm. I've worked in dream groups as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That even though, especially in younger people, I won't even say that.
Okay.
Even though we know these symbols are a projection of ourselves, I find a lot of people have a hard time realizing that those symbols are really about themselves.
Right. Right.
And it's a big one. And, right. And someone will say, but it's about that person. And
yeah. Some people are nodding and laughing in the room. And thank you as well for bringing that up. What I would say about that is that the opportunity of this work is to have that, on one level, to have that experience. Because we all project. I project. I will until the day I die, and then who knows what happens after that, right? I might keep projecting someplace. But the idea of projection, the idea that I like around projection, is that we do it just like when we want to see a good movie. We can't see it unless it's projected onto something. And, you know, when we're projecting things, it's an opportunity to recognize, oh, wow. Wow. When so-and-so says, you know, I ought to work in the banking industry, I have this reaction. You know, I want to do this. What does that say about me? Yeah. So, the thing that I find to be the most helpful around that is just to keep reminding myself, and if I'm in a group setting, to keep reminding the group that, well, you know, we're working with some projections here, and, you know, I have mine, and the practice of keep coming back to that, it takes all of us some time to integrate, you know. And so, like, when a dream is shared and we work it, the projections that come out might take several years to actually own and integrate. Some of them might be integratable earlier, you know. So it's a really good point that you bring up. Thank you.
Do you ever find that at times you dream for another?
That's a really good question, and that comes up from time to time. Oh, I myself would be hard-pressed to say that, but, well, let me give you an example. There's one extremely striking example. When my father was sick with lung cancer and I was staying with him in Colorado, I was staying with my sister. And as these things can tend to go, nobody had an idea, you know, least of all my dad, how long he was going to be around. So we were just kind of hanging out, you know, and trying to spend some time together. I woke up one morning and I had a dream. And the dream is that I'm next to the ocean. And I'm there with my sister, and it's kind of quiet. And all of a sudden, this big kind of tsunami-type wave starts building out there on the ocean. And I know that it's going to come in, and I wake up. And I woke up that morning, and, you know, death and other crises and other soulful experiences can, you know, kind of clarify us. And I think I was in an extremely clear period there, being with my dad. But I said to my sister, I was having some coffee in the morning, and she's like, hey man, how you doing? And I said, you know, I just want to tell you, I had this dream last night, and I think something big's going to happen today. And it was like an hour later that my father left his body. Yeah. Mm. So the issue of, in this example, the issue of, do we dream for other people? Maybe I was dreaming a little bit for my dad, to be able to be available to him in that moment. Maybe I was dreaming a little bit for my sister, to be able to say, hey, you know, something's coming down the pike, we need to get ready for it. And there are several examples in the riotous dream research literature that address this issue of dreaming for another.
There are many
dream researchers and dream theorists that have followed this question. Can anybody think of, in any of Jeremy Taylor's books, any examples of that?
I don't know about Jeremy Taylor.
Yeah, other examples, sure.
Achuar people in South America.
Yes.
Community dreaming.
Yes.
They get up in the morning and they discuss their dreams.
The
idea of an individual is not in the conversation.
Right, right.
It's a shared experience.
Right, right. Got you. Yeah. I would say that if one looks hard enough, it's fairly easy to find examples of that sort. Yeah.
Well, in looking at dreams, you'd be looking at it at, you know, many, many levels.
Mm.
And then there's the one level where everything in the dream that's happening is you.
Yes.
Then there's other levels where it's not maybe as much projection as it is reflection, that your relationships to other people are starting to be reflected in your dreams and are coming back to you. And then you can take it up to the major community level, the world level. You can take it to the basic psychic experience that any one of us will have as a human being, as a human, not just as an individual, but as a human being.
Yeah.
So you have all these different levels, and your dream is manifesting any one of those, and you can probably access each one of those levels, and they're all happening at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. Well said. Thank you. That's very much the experience of this work as we do it in groups.
That's what I was going to say. That's what's exciting about it, and that's why the more people you have involved in it, you get to all of those layers of different things. People at different times come up with their projection that give another perspective. And that sometimes if I'm just one-on-one talking with my friends, you say, oh, I had this dream, I feel blind. It's like, where's the rest of the group? Because I can only see this one piece that's about me. So that, and that's what I find so exciting about the group aspect of it, is because it is all there, and that's also why I like the projective form, because it embraces every one of those perspectives.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, to me, it's a great model, because there's an allowance for the diversity of experience. There's an allowance for the diversity of past human experience. You know, any diverse number of people who gather and agree to do this work together in the way that it's set out in terms of the guidelines, I feel strongly will have a good experience of working a dream. And that's beautiful, because it's, you know, it's inclusive, there's diversity, there's the multi-layered. And the interesting thing is, when doing group work, one of the things that we necessarily include is the acknowledgement that we are going to arbitrarily finish this work now, because we could keep going, because all that stuff is there. And it's like, it just kind of gets, and that's the thing, like, I would say that's one of the dynamics of the unconscious, and that's why I kind of like the metaphor of the ocean, because you keep going deeper and you keep finding more and more stuff, and maybe it gets a little weirder, you know, and a little more entertaining. Yeah. Other comments? We are going to move towards a sound healing here shortly. I want to make sure.
I just had, I didn't want to, if anyone else had that. Dream reentry. Do you ever work with dream reentry, where you have a dream and then you want to go back and you want to explore it further?
Yeah, that's fascinated me a lot. I've wanted to do that, and it kind of falls into the category of dream work techniques that don't personally appeal to me, because it seems to require a lot of effort and a lot of diligence. Some of the approaches to lucid dreaming are also like this for me personally, that I have to every time I turn around, I have to look at my hands and say, am I dreaming? You know, during the course of a day, it's too much for me. You know, it's too much for me. It's too much. I can't go there. But my sense is that the unconscious and the psyche, who I didn't say earlier, is considered to be the messenger who brings the dream, the soul bringing the dream out of the limitless, vast ocean of the unconscious. Well, the psyche knows. That's a saying from archetypal psychology. So what I need to dream, I will dream. What I need to remember, I will remember. But there are certainly, I've met people that can do that and they like to do it. And if it works for you, then go for it. Yeah. Yes.
Are you referring to active imagination, reworking the dream through active imagination?
No. The question that I understood you to be asking was, if a dream is recalled, and then if I want to pick up where that dream left off, like go back to the ice cream store where Uncle Louie's playing James Brown and there's, you know, lightning flashes coming out of the sky, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, that dream.
Yeah, that one. All right. Good. I'm glad I'm not alone here.
What the purpose of doing that would be? Like, why would you want to go back and do reentry? And was it to change the outcome or just to go back and
explore? Uh-huh. To go back and get more information and see it from a different vantage. And yeah.
And this, yeah.
I've done some of that. When something felt unfinished, I got so far in the dream and it felt not completed, and I wanted to complete it and understand and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't do it the next night in a dream. I do it in a trance state, mm-hmm. a shamanic trance state, mm-hmm. which is really pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
And going back to it the next night, that sounds more challenging.
Okay. Yeah. And I was gonna just quickly say, like, active imagination is like the Jungian concept of doing that, of looking at the dream while we're awake and letting the imaginal elements of the dream become present and then allowing the images in the dream to go where they will or take us where they will. Yeah.
I think it's a possibility in terms of the reentry of the dream situation that you could have dreams, several dreams over a period of nights, and you don't recognize that you're actually re-entering into them and continuing the story, because the nature of dreaming is such that it can be very chaotic and fragmented and you don't understand what the connections are, but you actually are continuing that story over several nights. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Well, unless, yeah.
I was just going to say, it's one of the things that's happened in the group is sometimes other members of the group will say, hey, this is the first dream you've had about falling down the well. And the dreamer will go, what? I don't remember that. But because you have the group there with the group memory, you start to pick up themes mm-hmm. that you might not otherwise, certainly as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, unless there are any more lingering comments or questions, I think I'd like to do a brief sound healing.
Yeah.
Okay. And let me just say, this is one of the unique aspects of the work as I'm doing it. What I do at the end of groups, or sometimes at the beginning, and at the end of one-on-one sessions, is open myself to creating a song, and also sometimes, you know, work with the person or the people that I'm working with to create a song that expresses the experience, synthesizes and synergizes the experience that we've just had. So, in the form of Tibetan bowls and didgeridoos, I offer this synergizing synthesis. And I think it might be nice just to kind of, you know, break after I do this. So let me just say, before I do this, thank you so much for being here tonight. Almost every chair was full, and really awesome to be here and to be entrusted to speak about dreams and dreaming with you all. And I feel the connection that's happened with the listening in the room is a close one, and I'm just really appreciative for that. And also thank you to Many Rivers for having us and for having me here. Very much appreciated. I also have flyers about my dream work. if for any reason you think you'd like to contact me, one-on-one work. I'm actually gathering a group in Occidental that's going to meet on a regular basis. Looks like I probably have two people so far. And it could, depending on where people are located, it could end up being three people. I've just been reminded that I have three people so far.
Four people.
Well, in my projected version of the dream, I was thinking that I only had two.
It takes a group.
Because sometimes I have a problem recognizing the abundance of life. It could also end up being in Sebastopol, is what I was going to say, depending on if there are folks, if there are folks here tonight who are interested. I have a book here, and you can just put your info in this book when we finish up. Give me your email and your phone number. And I also have one more thing before we come to an arbitrary close. I'm doing a CD release party for my new meditation yoga ambient CD, which is the Yoro Yoro CD on the right there that I have copies of with me tonight. But I'm going to be doing some live renditions of that on the 28th in Occidental at the West County Herb Company. Please, please, please come and join us. And there's flyers here for that.
And that's a new event space that people don't know.
It is a new event space.
It'll be like the first event. It's incredible. It'll be the space.
And with that, let us do a sound healing. Feel free to close your eyes. Feel free to take some deep breaths. And when I'm done, I'll just stop and come on back when you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks everyone for coming.